is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The deliberate denial of medicine, fuel, food and water to the residents of Gaza is tantamount to genocide.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on Israel's response in Gaza to Hamas attacks on Israel. Details coming up. Also, many crimes against women and girls have become weapons of war in Sudan and neighboring South Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The start of Israelis' pause in fighting was due to be announced by early Thursday, according to Qatar. An Israeli government statement said an extra day would be added beyond the initial four-day pause for every additional 10 hostages Hamas releases. The Israeli pause will also allow for more humanitarian convoys to bring aid into Gaza, including fuel for humanitarian efforts. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to bring back all of the hostages while reiterating to cabinet members that Israel's goal is to eliminate Hamas and ensure the militant group can no longer threaten Israel. Meanwhile, a majority of South African lawmakers yesterday voted in favor of a motion calling for the closure of the Israeli embassy and the cutting of diplomatic ties until Israel agrees to a ceasefire in Gaza. And on the West Bank front, reports indicate Israeli settlers have increased attacks on Palestinian rural communities since the start of the war. To sort out and brief us more on the matter, reporter Linda Gradstein is standing by in Jerusalem. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you.
So I guess the big news today is the pause in the fighting, and at least 50 Hamas hostages, women and children, will be released along with Palestinians held by Israel.
Yes. So it's supposed to begin Thursday morning, in other words, tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Israel time, with the first release of the group of the Israeli hostages. And then the fighting will be paused for 4 days. In addition, a large amount of humanitarian aid and fuel will be allowed to enter Gaza. And at some point during that 4 days, 150 Palestinian prisoners, men under the age of 19 and women, will also be freed, although there aren't as many details on that. In terms of the Israeli hostages, they will be the Hamas will hand them to the Red Cross. Then the Red Cross will then bring them to Israeli soldiers. Once they cross back into Israel, they will be taken to isolated medical facilities where they'll reunite with their families and, of course, have medical checks.
And President Biden welcomed the ceasefire deal, and he said extraordinarily gratified that some of these brave souls who have endured weeks of captivity and unspeakable ordeal will be reunited with their families once this deal is fully implemented. So who was behind the deal?
Well, the deal, the negotiations, first of all, it was several weeks, and it was a combination of Qatar, Egypt, and the United States. In fact, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu thanked President Biden for helping make the deal better than it had been originally, maybe in terms of numbers of hostages, or it wasn't exactly clear what he meant. And, of course, the feeling in Israel is both hopeful but also very nervous, and the fact that it's just 50 out of the 240 hostages.
And talk to us about the West Bank and about reports indicating Israeli settlers are increasing attacks in the West Bank.
Yes. Well, there has long been a lot of tension between at least some Israeli settlers and Palestinians. You know, some of the Israeli settlers are extremists. And, you know, since the war began, there has definitely been an increase in both clashes with the Israeli army and Jewish settlers. And at least 8 Palestinians have been killed by Jewish settlers. So, and in some of these very small, there are some very poor, small farming communities of Palestinians, and they've actually left because they're so afraid of the Israeli settlers.
So where does the death toll stand right now on both sides?
So the Israeli death toll is about 1,200, most of whom were killed on that first day of fighting when Hamas came in and attacked all these different Israeli communities. In the actual fighting in Gaza, 68 Israeli soldiers have been killed. The death toll on the Palestinian side, the only figure we have is from the Hamas-run health ministry, which says that more than 14,000 people have been killed and that two-thirds of them are women and children.
And the aid and the fuel situation in Gaza, will this hostage release thing maybe alleviate the burden on the Gaza citizens? Will aid start coming in into Gaza because of the agreement?
Well, yes. I mean, Israel has allowed in some aid, but it's been not enough. There's quite a bit of aid that the international community has sent that's sort of waiting to get into Gaza. And yes, that's the idea that a lot of that there would be an opening and a lot more food and water and fuel would also get in during these 4 days. That said, United Nations officials say that their facilities, schools and things like that, are completely packed with more than nine times the amount that it was originally set up for. There's been widespread destruction in northern Gaza by the Israeli army. So I think it might alleviate some of it, but it won't provide any kind of a long-term solution for the population of Gaza.
So this Israeli-Hamas agreement to a temporary ceasefire for humanitarian purposes that includes a hostage release deal, how is it being taken where you are? How are people reacting to the news?
So I think it's kind of a mixed reaction. On one hand, the hostage families, have gotten a tremendous amount of sympathy, and there are posters of the hostages all over Israel on benches and on billboards, and there are all these, art installations. And so I think people are very sympathetic for these families and want their family members to be released, especially, we're talking about 40 of the hostages are children. So this idea of children, some of whom are held without their parents, people are very sympathetic. At the same time, I think people are a bit concerned that it will mean that Israel will have to stop the war before they have dealt sort of a final blow to Hamas. There's concern that after 4 days, or perhaps if the ceasefire is extended 5 days, there will be a lot of pressure on Israel not to go back to the fighting. Israeli officials today say that they intend to go back to fighting, and that this war for them in Gaza has had two goals all along. The first is freedom for all of the hostages, and the second is making sure that Hamas can never provide a military threat the way that it did on October 7th.
Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem briefing us on the latest. Thank you for your input.
Thank you, Yehias.
South Africa's largest opposition party and main Jewish representative body have slammed Parliament's decision to cut diplomatic ties with Israel. Kate Bartlett reports a majority of lawmakers voted yesterday for the motion to close Israel's embassy in Pretoria because of Israel's actions in Gaza.
During a heated session in South Africa's parliament on Tuesday, all members of the governing African National Congress, which has a long history of solidarity with the Palestinians, voted in favor of cutting ties with Israel. Many wore Palestinian scarves and burst into song after the motion, originally brought by radical opposition party the Economic Freedom Fighters, passed. The vote is non-binding, but it is now up to the government to decide whether to act on the motion. President Cyril Ramaphosa's spokesman, Vincent Magwenya, read a statement.
The president notes and appreciates Parliament's guidance on our diplomatic relations with Israel, particularly with respect to the status of the Israeli embassy in South Africa. President Ramaphosa and Cabinet are engaged over the matter, which remains the responsibility of the National Executive.
On the day of the vote, Ramaphosa chaired a virtual meeting of leaders of the BRICS group of developing nations, which include Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, on the situation in the Middle East, where Gaza health officials say at least 11,000 people have been killed by Israeli military operations. At the BRICS meeting, Chinese President Xi Jinping described Israeli actions as collective punishment of people in Gaza, with Ramaphosa going further.
The deliberate denial of medicine, fuel, food and water to the residents of Gaza is tantamount to genocide.
South Africa's main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, voted against the motion. Emma Powell, Shadow Minister for International Relations and Cooperation, warned afterwards that cutting ties would leave thousands of South Africans in Israel without access to emergency consular services and affect South Africa's representative office in Ramallah.
The ANC have rendered our own citizens entirely trapped with no way of accessing diplomatic assistance from their government.
The Israeli embassy in Pretoria was not available for comment. Israel's ambassador was recalled to Israel for consultations ahead of the parliamentary vote. However, Mary Cluck, vice president of the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, an umbrella organization representing the country's sizable Jewish community, deplored parliament's decision.
This vote had nothing to do with peace, and it was confirmed for me when I was watching on television the chanting of From the River to the Sea, a clear call for the destruction of the Jewish state.
South Africa recently referred Israel to the International Criminal Court for potential war crimes in Gaza. Israel says it is acting in self-defense after gunmen with the militant group Hamas killed an estimated 1,200 people on October 7th in the deadliest single attack on Israeli civilians in the history of the State of Israel. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Recent United Nations studies show almost one in three women, about 736 million worldwide, have experienced physical sexual violence from someone close to them. The studies show that when it comes to lethal violence, on average, more than five women or girls are killed every hour by someone in their own family. In Sudan and neighboring South Sudan, many crimes against women and girls are weapons of war. Nairobi reporter James Shimanyula has more.
The United Nations says there is no official body in South Sudan that collects data on the number of women and children who have been victims of sexual violence in South Sudan. The UN has said sexual violence is used in Sudan tactic to displace and terrorize rival communities where fighting continues between the Sudan army and the paramilitary rapid support forces. UN studies also show that forced marriage and sexual slavery are chronic features of conflict. They argued that perpetrators be punished regardless of rank. The United Nations Human Rights Office in Sudan has received credible reports of 21 incidents of conflict-related violence against at least 57 women and at least 10 girls. In South Sudan, the UN reports that this year there have been multiple attacks in which as many as 20 women were raped. Yasmin Soka is the head of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan.
The Commission's investigation team just returned from a number of missions in hotspots around South Sudan, particularly Southern Unity State. There they documented the gang rapes of women multiple times, the gang rapes of children and the elderly as well. For many of these women, this is not the first time that this has happened. The challenge for the survivors is that they're not able to access immediate medical care.
Soka says some culprits are government officials and said the government in Juba should investigate and prosecute them.
While we've seen military trials, the reality, of course, is they don't actually get accountable. And that sends a message to survivors that the government doesn't really care about what is happening to them.
The Juba government has not responded efforts to get a response on Soka's remarks. Rachel Yuan is a South Sudan activist and academic.
I have grown up against the backdrop of a country at war. For most of my life, many other youth who make up over 70% of the population, we have become all too familiar with the violence of weapons, sexual violence.
In neighboring Sudan, conflict-related sexual violence is widespread and systematic. General Abdel Fattah Burhan, leader of the Sudanese army, accuses members of the paramilitary rapid support forces of committing many sexual assaults. The RSF is under the command of Burhan's one-time deputy, General Hamdan Dagalo. Liz Throssell is the spokesperson for the United Nations Human Rights Office.
Women and girls are being abducted and held in inhuman, degrading, slave-like conditions in areas controlled by the rapid support forces in Darfur. These shocking reports come amid a persistent increase in cases of sexual violence in the country since fighting broke out between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces 6 months ago.
Diplomats say since April 15, when fighting erupted, the RSF has controlled most of the capital Khartoum and central Sudan. According to the diplomats, the Sudanese army controls Port Sudan on the Red Sea and most of the rest of the country. For VOA Africa News, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The White House says the U.S. intelligence chief secured promises from the leaders of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to de-escalate a surge in violence. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines traveled to the two countries Sunday and Monday and said the United States would monitor their efforts. Rwandan President Paul Kagame and DRC President Felix Tshisekedi each offered commitments to Haines to reduce tensions in eastern DRC. Kinshasa accuses the M23 rebels, who are primarily Tutsis, of enjoying support from Rwanda, a claim publicly backed by the United States. The trip by Haines, who has accompanied by top U.S. officials on Africa, comes as international powers try to encourage calm in the run-up to presidential elections in the DRC on December the 20th. Joint operations between Congolese and Ugandan soldiers have allowed some health facilities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to reopen after militia fighting has closed them. Reporter Zanim Neti Zaidi visited the Coca-Cola Health Center and has this report.
Surrounded by enormous forests, the buildings of the Coca-Cola Health Center are dilapidated. The facility in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo was abandoned 9 years ago following an attack by ADF rebels. Head nurse Kasereka Kasai is helping get the unit back up and running. He says they want to relaunch the activities of the health center, and this has been the wish of the population for a long time. The health center has been closed for 9 years and has been looted. There is no more furniture. The metal sheets have been pierced by bullets. There is a lot of work to do and there is a need for help. Coca-Cola sits about 50 kilometers south of the city of Beni in the eastern DRC. There are about 500 households there now, but thousands of other residents fled the area when the Allied Defense Forces, or ADF militants, took control of the region several years ago. The health center reopened last week. The chief of the community, Edgar Kamalendo, thinks the health center now could encourage the return of the residents who had fled the ADF attack. He says he is delighted to see that his hospital is now operational. He appealed to his constituents who had fled to know that the hospital had resumed its activities. The ADF is an Islamist movement that originated in Uganda nearly 30 years ago and then moved to the DRC. It is allied with the Islamic State extremist group. The group is one of the largest of the more than 100 rebel militias operating in the eastern DRC. Joint military operations by the DRC Army and the Ugandan Army that began 2 years ago have pushed the ADF out of Coca-Cola area. The resumption of activities at the Coca-Cola Health Center has brought relief to residents such as Kasereka Mahinda, He hopes that from now on, their difficulties in accessing health care will be eased. He says that this health center is a large structure that was burned down by the AF and nothing worked anymore. He says that people suffered because of the lack of access to medicines. Despite the reopened health facility, the presence of the ADF rebels remains a threat to the community. Military operations continue in this area to keep the ADF out. For VOA Africa, I'm Zane Mneti Zaidi in Goma.
Hamisa Zaja, founder and chairperson of the Coast Association for Persons with Disabilities in Kenya, was recently named one of the four finalists for the U.S. Institute of Peace 2023 Woman Building Peace Award. She talked to VOA's Carol Van Dam.
We realized many of our colleagues living with disabilities were involved in the post-election violences, and they were either killed because they could not see, killed because they could not run. They were either killed because they could not hear what was happening. So we thought we are suffering and we are victim of circumstances, and that's what brought us together. And I formed the Coast Association for Persons Living with Disability so that we can raise our voice. We can tell the people we can be in peacemaking. We can be on the table, the decision table. We can speak out for ourselves.
What kinds of things do you do, these very viable alternatives for people that, so that they feel like they can be living a worthwhile life and earning a living? And what can they do to turn away from violence?
I've been doing a lot of work when I realized that many of the youths and women participate in the violences because of they don't have anything to do, because of different grievances. Some of them, they have been denied their land. Some of them, their kids have been killed. Some of them, they found themselves in violence extremism. Some of them, disappearances, extrajudiciary killings. So what happened is when we realized that people are lured into violence, I decided to be forming initiative to do some small initiative, but they are income generating projects.
Give me an example of one of those projects.
Many of those projects are, I turned public toilets into income generating activity. I talked to the government of Mombasa and several other county governments. We agreed, and I looked for a partner, donor, or we called sponsors. They renovated. I kept structures like there will be some people who will be collecting funds. We call them cashier. There will be those people who will be giving detergents. There'll be those people who will be filling the tanks for water so that we can get water. There are those people who will be now taking the funds to the bank. So I kept structures, and I kept women, youth, and persons living with disabilities.
Extremist groups are in Kenya, but also they're in DRC, Mali, lots of other places in Africa. Do you hope to spread your particular kind of peace-building work to other countries?
Yeah. I wish to spread this worldwide, because worldwide, we have persons living with disabilities, and they are all becoming victims of circumstances. Because when the world is sitting down, the major tables that the world is sitting down, they have never been a recognition or a voice of persons living with disability. So because of that, I use that as an entry point for peace. That we need to be there, we need to discuss. And when we have that recognition like this, I can talk to even go to every country and tell them about peace, how peace can give us development, how peace, you see, sitting down and doing dialogue, we might agree, we might disagree, we might agree to disagree. So there are alternatives. And also, we can initiate projects that they keep every one of us busy.
Hamisa Zaja, Coast Association for Persons with Disabilities. And with that, we wrap up this edition of